Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Pat Barron. I'm standing in for the regular host and founder of Radio Free Market, Michael McKay, who is taking a well-deserved vacation this week. Well, we are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is the path from big government to smaller government. And our guest is Kevin Williamson, who is Deputy Managing Editor of National Review Magazine. He's a columnist for The New Criterion and a professor at the King's College. Kevin is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism, which is coming out just next month. I'm looking forward to getting that, Kevin. And his work has appeared in The New York Post, Commentary, The Indian Express, Our Sunday Visitor, and other publications, including National Review itself, where I've read many very, very good articles by Kevin. Kevin is working on what he refers to as his, quote, big book, unquote, which he has provisionally titled After Leviathan. And his thesis is that the current size and scope of government is not sustainable, and that society will organize itself along other lines. So, welcome, Kevin.
Hey, Pat, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Well, Kevin, you sent me the outline of your new book. You had the first couple chapters written, and I tell you, really, I could not put it down. It's wonderful writing, and you're laying out what a market-oriented society would look like. And you say, I believe, and you can talk about this, that this is inevitable. And first of all, tell us, why is going from big government to smaller government inevitable?
Well, I don't want to say that I think it's inevitable. I would say that there are enormous economic, financial, and political pressures pushing us that way, and that our current model of a large, high-revenue, high intervention welfare state is unsustainable. So where we are in history, I think, is that we have a choice in front of us, which is, do we want to make the arrangements and provisions to make the transition to a more free society, a more market-driven society, or do we want to try to cling blindly to what we've been doing in the past? And if we attempt to do that, we are going to inflict catastrophe on ourselves. We will have, you know, an Argentina-style currency meltdown. We will have fiscal crises from here to the historical horizon, probably social disorder and unrest. So there's a real choice in front of us. What is inevitable is that our current model of government is going to change, because it simply is, you know, it's mathematically not sustainable. It's not going to happen. One of the things I often tell Republicans who are very upset about things like Obamacare is that they really shouldn't worry about it too much, because even though the law's been passed, it's not going to happen. We don't have the money to implement it. The economics of it are so bad and so backward that it's probably not implementable. And so, a lot of the things that we'd like to change, entitlements, government involvement in healthcare, government overreach overseas, things like that, those things are going to change whether we want them to or not. The question is, are we going to have an orderly transition that produces something that's better and more liberal and more fruitful and more productive, or are we going to have disorder? As Murray Rothbard put it, are we going to have chaos or are we going to have anarchy?
Very good. I think what really got me was in the first couple chapters of your book. You say that although there's various ways to calculate this, that our current unfunded liabilities for the nation amount to over $130 trillion.
All the money in the world. It's more than global GDP, more than the whole world's money supply.
Right. In fact, I calculate if you just divide $130 trillion by the 300 million American population, that means that every man, woman, and child in America is on the hook for over $400,000 right now.
Right, which means it's not going to get paid.
That's just unsustainable. Well, folks, this first little segment of ours has come to an end very quickly, so I would like you to stand by. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Pat Barron, and we're talking with Kevin Williamson about going from big government to smaller government. So please stand by after the break. Well, folks, this is Pat Barron, your guest host on Radio Free Market, and my guest today is Kevin Williamson from National Review Magazine. And Kevin, during the break, I would like your readers, listeners to know, the listeners out there to know that you're going to be on Bill Bennett's show tomorrow. Now, this is going to be recorded, but I would imagine that folks may be able to archive that, and you'll be on Fox TV. So congratulations for that.
Oh, thanks.
I will watch it live. You know, we talked about, you know, the end of big government is coming, but can we really live without big government? Or are we just going to go to some kind of, is it mandatory that we go to some sort of more command and control economy?
Yeah, well, a couple of things about that. One is that because of our national identity as Americans, you know, we really take our sense of national identity from our Constitution and from our form of government. You know, we're not a traditional sort of ethnic state or traditional sort of religious state where your national identity comes from your heritage, from land and soil and altar and throne and all that sort of stuff. We're really have been defined by our political traditions, which means that we invest a lot emotionally in a large sense of our national identity in our political institutions, which is good in some ways because it makes us a very open society. You know, you can become an American in a way that you can't really become Chinese or something like that. But the truth is that these things change and that the American people and the American nation is what it is, regardless of its particular form of government. You know, we're the same people now that we were in 1914 or 1868, but we've got a radically different kind of government than we did then. The truth is, as I see it, that you know, government is essentially a consumer product. You know, government is like shampoo. It is laundry detergent. It's a car. It's a cell phone. It's something that is there to do particular things for you. There's certain kinds of tasks you want done. And the truth is that our current model of government just doesn't work for us anymore. I mean, it may have been a good model in the 1930s. It may have been a good model in the 1920s. It may have been a good model at some other time, although I have my doubts about whether it was ever really a very, very good model at any time, although it has been very stable over the years. And we've had, you know, compared to the rest of the world, an outstanding government. But the truth is that it cannot do what we want it to do, and it can't do what we want it to do for the means that we have available. I mean, if we had infinite money and infinite wealth and there was no such thing as scarcity, then, yeah, you can do whatever you want to with government. But ours, you know, government, in a sense, is a promise. I mean, government like ours is a promise, and it's made all sorts of promises about Social Security, about national defense, about entitlements, about taxes, about other sorts of things. And the truth is those promises are not going to be kept. They simply cannot be kept. It doesn't have $400,000 for every citizen. It doesn't have $130 trillion or more to settle its liabilities. So, you know, if you would ask someone 100 years ago what a telephone would look like in the year 2010, they wouldn't have been able to tell you. If you'd ask them what a television would look like or how newspapers would be delivered, you know, online as opposed to in print form, they wouldn't have been able to tell you. There's been lots of innovation in the world, particularly in the areas of the world that actually work really well. You know, our telecommunications is great, but our government services stink. There's a reason for that. And that's because people in the private sector have to compete for revenue. They have to innovate. They have to bring quality up and prices down, whereas the state doesn't have to do that. So it's hard for me to say what the institutions that I think will replace our kind of command and control institutions will look like 100 years from now or 200 years from now or even 10 or 20 years from now. But I do think that if we play our cards right, we can evolve, you know, freer, more effective alternatives.
Well, and I think that a lot of the alternatives we can look historically that, yes, things did work without a department of any kind of welfare department, welfare entitlements. People still were taken care of in some manner and probably, I believe, taken care of better and at more of a more of a cooperative, loving Christian type environment too.
Yeah, you know the federal welfare state imposes horrible costs, and not just financial costs. You know, when you have this kind of one size fits all command and control model of things, you end up doing just terrible, terrible things. You know, where I live, the poorest congressional district in the United States, in Jose Serrano's district, And the reason for that isn't because there's some sort of, natural blight that has caused people to be poor there. It's because the predominant form of housing is federal housing projects, where the income typically is $0.00 per year. So what we did was we took, housing for poor people, which had been widely dispersed and mixed throughout the city, which actually was a good thing for most people because poor people benefit tremendously by having less poor neighbors because they get better public services, they get better policing, they get better schools, they get a better environment. It's a healthy thing to have people mixed up in society. What we did was we created these ghettos, these segregated, concentrated, walled-off, enormous buildings and complexes of buildings where the poor are housed exclusively. All the people they interact with are equally impoverished and dependent on government, so they don't have a chance to do things like engage in the kind of social networking that helps people find jobs, connect with opportunities, things like that. Now, no one ever planned it to turn out that way. They just thought, well, here's an efficient method to do things, and they built them exactly the way we build prisons. And our schools are built the way we built prisons as well. I don't know if you've ever been through a New York City public school, but it's exactly like walking into a prison in Texas. There's the control at the door, there's the metal detector, there's the security, the bells and the door controls and all the rest of it. So no one ever intended to inflict these externalities both on society and on the poor that we're actually allegedly trying to help with these programs, but that's the way they turned out. So would we be able to do better for the people who really need social services? Well, yeah, I think so. As you pointed out, we had other models in the past for doing this, and I think there are probably other models in the future. One of the things I'm particularly interested in is the 19th century mutual aid societies. It was particularly prominent among Northeastern ethnic immigrant groups like the Irish and the Italians, where they would have these benevolent societies, as they were known. And what they were essentially was small, cooperatively owned insurance companies that offered various kinds of social insurance for things like disability and unemployment and sickness and things like that, where people actually were able to get together and contribute a little bit of money from their very, very modest incomes and provide a form of mutual social insurance. And I think that's the sort of thing I would like to see us doing more of. I think it would make society not only free, but more stable and more happy. One of the reasons that people tend to look to big government is because we're insecure. Even though we're the wealthiest, safest, healthiest people there have ever been in the world, we have a great deal of insecurity. We feel vulnerable about things, because you can have one heart attack and it's a $500,000 hospital bill and you can't pay it and you're broke forever, right? So that's why people turn to big government. We can take away a good deal of that social insecurity and that economic insecurity by using much more effective methods of risk management than we've used in the past.
Yeah, I hear you because my father was an insurance salesman,
mm-hmm.
and I grew up, learning what exactly is insurance, and it's a very cooperative thing. Most people at that time, this is when I was a child back in the 50s and 60s, early 60s. Life insurance was for two things. Number one, it was if when you passed away, your funeral expenses would be paid. In effect,
right.
You are saving for that all your life with your very modest contribution monthly payments to the insurance company. And then the other one was for if your untimely demise, for whatever reason, the insurance money would be there to take care of your widow and orphans.
Right.
And that was a private thing. My father worked for a private insurance company. He wasn't working for a government, so-called government insurance company. I think insurance is one of the ways that people handle a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, and the thing is we tend to insure against the wrong things, because of the way our healthcare system is set up and it's all third-party payers, we're trying to insure against things that we know are going to happen. When you turn 50, you're going to need certain kinds of examinations. You're going to need a prostate cancer exam, right? It's not something really to insure against, but we buy health insurance expecting to offset all of these costs involved with healthcare and things like that we know are going to come. You know you're going to need a checkup. You know you're going to need dental cleaning and all that sort of thing. But we buy insurance against that, even though it's not really an insurable risk, because if the risk of something happening is 100% by a certain day, then it's not really an insurable risk. But we spend very little money insuring ourselves against the things that we really ought to insure ourselves against. You know, most people don't carry additional private disability insurance. Most people don't carry long-term chronic disease or care insurance. Most people don't carry private income insurance or private unemployment insurance, partly because there's crowding out through the welfare state and partly because people just don't like to think about those things. But that's the sort of stuff that you really ought to insure against. You know, we've been in this big debate over the last couple of months about extending unemployment benefits. And while I can certainly see the case for saying, well, hey, these are publicly funded, so, you know, 99 weeks is more than enough. But the truth is, particularly for some, you know, upper-income people, it can take a year, 2 years, 3 years to get yourself back to where you had been if you were in a fairly high-paying job. And you've got obligations to meet in the meantime. I think, you know, if people were smart, they would fund out-of-pocket, out of their own pocket, you know, very serious lost income insurance for those sorts of things. You might want to have a 5-year plan or a 4-year plan that would make up lost income if your company goes out of business or if you become disabled or something else happens, because that's a real huge life-changing thing, and that is the kind of thing that you ought to be able to insure against.
Yeah, they used to call that, you know, saving for a rainy day. And for what?
Yeah, certainly. And but there are more effective ways to save, of course.
Well, this is very interesting, and once again, Kevin, we're coming to the end of a segment that goes very quickly on this show, and you're a wonderful, wonderful guest. It's very fascinating, all the things you're telling us. So, folks, when we come back after this short commercial break, we'll be talking once again with Kevin Williamson. Kevin is an author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism, coming out next month, and he's an editor of National Review Magazine. So, Kevin, hold on the line, and folks, we'll be right back. Well, folks, welcome back. This is Pat Barron, your guest host for Radio Free Market, and our guest today is Kevin Williamson from National Review Magazine, and we've been having a fascinating conversation about how to transition from big government to smaller government. And, Kevin, I would like to just go back a little bit. Last segment you talked about the way we could provide many of our things that make us insecure, how we could insure against that through mutual aid societies and things like that. But getting back even further than that, a lot of folks are saying, what's going on out there right now? Are we approaching the point that we really have to take this seriously? Are we approaching the end of big government as we know it?
I think yes. I mean, it's always, you know, dangerous to make predictions like this, and you're giving a hostage to fortune and all the rest of it. But what's going on in the world right now does not look like a normal business cycle recession, I think, to almost anybody. I mean, none of the serious economists who I read and consult with on these things thinks it looks like a normal business cycle recession. There's something else going on there. And what's going on, of course, is a series of fiscal crises, not having to do with private enterprise, but having to do with insolvent states. You know, the Eurozone is on the edge of falling apart. Previously, allegedly, and purportedly prosperous nations like Ireland and possibly Portugal and possibly Spain are needing bailouts from their neighbors. The truth is the European Union does not have enough money collectively to bail out all of the European Union members. They're going to need bailouts. There are going to be almost certainly defaults and haircuts given to bondholders. And we're about to see the same thing start happening in the United States. If you just take state and local employee pension obligations alone, you've got $3 trillion in unfunded liabilities. At least 27 states are heading toward insolvency just from their pension plans alone, not to mention the rest of their spending and other sorts of problems. So, I mean, do we have the sorts of resources where 27 U.S. states can get bailed out by the rest of them? That doesn't seem to me very likely. The federal government certainly doesn't have the money to do it. They can print money, which they've been doing, and monetizing the debt, but eventually the markets are going to look at that and demand higher interest rates, which is going to completely change the calculus. You know, what the Europeans have been up to and what we're about to get up to is they're trying to head off default by almost any means, not because it's the smartest thing to do, it's the most economically viable thing to do, but because if some EU country defaults on its debt, every country in the world, except maybe Germany, maybe China, is going to have a much, much harder time borrowing money. And if there's one thing politicians love, they love it more than anything else. They love to be able to borrow money. You know, a politician without a national credit card is like a crack fiend without his crack. You know, they can't live without it. It's their favorite thing in the world. And to them, the definition of disaster is not national insolvency. It's not recession. It's not impoverishing their country. It's losing their ability to borrow money on the international credit markets. So that's what's going on right now. But the truth is, I mean, I don't think anyone who's looked at this thinks that it's sustainable. I mean, there are going to be defaults. I mean, there will be defaults through devaluation, or there'll be defaults through some, you know, formal restructuring that's not actually called a default, but everyone's going to know what it is, and it is coming. And you can't, you know, we couldn't engage in the level of spending that we're engaging in right now in the United States and fund it through taxes. We just couldn't do it. There's not enough money out there to get it done. You can't collect revenue on that level. We literally could not pay our unfunded pension liabilities, even if we took the tax rate up to 100%. There's just not the money there to do it. So, yeah, that is going to change. There's no question about it.
Yeah, you talking about how the problem is at governments at all levels. Just this weekend, I was visiting my 94-year-old father-in-law in Decatur, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up the paper over the weekend, and the headline was that Decatur, Illinois, which is an industrial town, central Illinois industrial town of about 50 or 60,000 people, 70% of the real estate tax revenue goes to paying current pensions for police, firemen, and city employees.
Oh, yeah.
So 30% of the revenue is what has to actually take care of the current expenses of the city.
Yeah.
70% is, and that's rising. There was a statistic that I can't really quite remember, but it was 5 years ago. It was much lower than 70%. It was something like 40%.
So yeah, Illinois actually is the worst off state in the union when it comes to the pension problems. There's one economist who thinks they could, you know, end up insolvent within the next year. Just on the basis of that. And you've got these little places like Decatur and little towns like that that are just outrageously over-leveraged in terms of these obligations. And the problem, of course, in Illinois, as in lots of other states, is that it's written both into state statute and into the Constitution that these pension payments cannot be lowered, they cannot be reneged upon, they have to be made. So you have a matter of constitutional law coming up against a matter of economic reality, which is they don't have the money to do it, which suggests to me, I mean, the employees' unions are not going to take this lying down. They're not going to agree to a reduction, even if they had the power to do that, which it's not clear that they do. So you're talking about this going probably to the Supreme Court in some sort of really nasty, protracted legal fight that's going to establish, you know, probably some sort of new area of bankruptcy law having to do with what states do when they go bankrupt, because we've never had a state go bankrupt before, so it's uncharted territory.
Well, that's really fascinating. I think it's a big topic, and all these segments, Kevin, they go very quickly, and we're actually coming to the end of another segment. And folks, we're with Kevin Williamson of National Review Magazine, and we'll be right back to discuss these important issues right after the break. Stay with us. Well, folks, this is Pat Barron, your guest host on Radio Free Market, talking with Kevin Williamson. And Kevin, what I'd like to get back to now in this, our longest segment, is talk more about, well, things are really getting to where the government's not going to be able to meet all its obligations. So what kind of things should the citizens of our country and really citizens of the world try to work toward to make sure that the new institutions we set up are more sustainable and more freedom-oriented? So why don't you take that ball and run with it?
Well, what we can do, first of all, is count on something that I have a great deal of faith in, and that is the fact that people don't want to be poor, miserable, hungry, and vulnerable. You know, people want to lead materially comfortable lives for the most part. I mean, there's the occasional fanatic out there who doesn't, but people for the most part want to be fat and happy and peaceful and work and own a home and raise their families. And people are really good at doing that sort of thing for the most part if left alone. You know, people tend to do a really good job at managing their own lives and a really bad job at managing other people's lives. So we've got, historically, precedents and models for helping people to evolve arrangements that will solve problems for them. You know, you can remember, I'm sure, within your lifetime and certainly within my lifetime, back when banking was something you had to pay for. You know, you had to pay the bank to open a checking account. Now the bank pays you. You can remember a time, and not that long ago, you know, when I was maybe in junior high in the middle 1980s, when a cellular phone was the size of a cinder block and it cost $10,000, and it worked for about 4 minutes. Now, there's a reason that our cell phones right now are a lot better than those were, and that everybody has one. They're cheap. They give them away for free. Service costs, you know, basically nothing. You can get it from $20 a month, you know, for the cost of 5 cups of coffee, essentially 6 cups of coffee if you go someplace cheaper than Starbucks. These things keep getting better and better, and it's not just that technology somehow improves itself over time. It's not really even primarily a technological question. You know, most of the raw technology that was necessary to make something like an iPhone exist was available years and years ago. It was really a financial process that made it available widespread and that made it a great market product. So what happens is that, you know, every year our cars get better, our phones get better, our computers get better, they get cheaper. There are features, they do things that no one would have even dreamed about 20 years ago. You know, our entertainment gets better. All the stuff that's delivered through the competitive marketplace gets better and cheaper every year. The things that don't get better and cheaper are the things that are being delivered through the state, which is, you know, national defense, public schools, healthcare, which even before Obamacare was half run by the government and heavily regulated, and then a lot of, you know, very regulated government-involved sectors tend to be defective in the economy too. Things like finance and banking, which you know something about, where the regulations you know, create a lot of sort of perverse incentives and cause the markets not to work as well as they do. Insurance is another example of that. So it's really difficult to say in advance, you know, what an institution would look like, a particular institution. What would healthcare look like in a totally free society? What would the enforcement of contracts look like in a totally free society? It's difficult to say for the same reason that it would be difficult to say, looking at a Model A Ford in 1920, what a modern car would look like, what a Prius would look like, or something like that. But you do know how to lay the ground to let people innovate to create these things, which the number one thing, of course, is get the government out of the way. The second thing is to allow a great deal of social, political, legal latitude for people to innovate and form cooperative arrangements. You know, homeschooling is a good example of this. You know, the homeschoolers are great. They're my favorite sort of radical movement in the country because they don't even think of themselves that way, but they really are. You know, where they're saying, fine, you can take our tax dollars, we'll still pay into the stupid government school system, but you're not getting our kids. We're going to educate them ourselves. We'll do it ourselves directly. And the homeschoolers have come up with all these great cooperative arrangements where they have you know, commercially developed curricula for people who maybe have expertise in one area but not in another. You know, not everybody knows everything that they need to teach their kids, and so they can go to the marketplace and find materials and textbooks and programs and things like that that work. They've got all sorts of wonderful institutions and arrangements they developed on their own, and they could be doing more of it, but we do still get in their way a lot. You know, I mean, the government still does not, they really dislike homeschoolers. You know, I wrote a piece a couple of months ago where there was this law professor, I forget where she was from, one of the better schools, and she was just apoplectic that these people should be allowed to educate their own children. I mean, how can we allow such a thing? Why isn't the government running this? And of course, you know, where I teach over at the King's College, you know, half of my students are maybe more homeschooled, and they tend to be better educated, they tend to be better adjusted socially, they tend to be in almost every way better off and better put together than their public school counterparts. So, you know, the schools do a lot of damage to kids in addition to wasting a lot of money. And so, yeah, we should, you know, make more room for things like that. We should make more room for people to come up with innovative, cooperative ways to fund health care for themselves and for people who can't afford it. We should certainly allow people to do much more in the realm of charity than they do. You know, the situation we had in New York State where Catholic Family Services was chased out of the adoption business, basically because they wouldn't serve same-sex couples. You know, that sort of thing is just, it's a net loss for society. I mean, there's no reason that somebody couldn't set up a competing adoption agency. There's no law against providing adoption services to same-sex couples, but the Catholic Church just chooses not to do it for its own religious and moral reasons, which is fine. But, you know, we aren't willing to say live and let live in a situation like that. We're not willing to say, okay, you've got your way of doing things. Someone else may have a different way of doing things. You know, let the Episcopalians handle the same-sex adoptions, right? But nobody is really willing to do that. We need to make more room for people, a greater platform for innovation, so we can apply the same sorts of forces and techniques that have made life materially so much better in so many ways to the one remaining realm where it hasn't really improved in the last 100 years, which is government.
Yeah, and it seems like the one the key ingredient here is just the simple idea of freedom. Give people the freedom to do what they wish. Good friend of mine, Dr. Patrick Burke. Do you know Patrick?
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Oh sure, Patrick Burke wrote a book. It's now maybe 10, 15 years ago, but it's still worth reading. It's called No Harm.
Yeah.
And his thesis was that people should be allowed to do anything they want as long as they don't harm anyone else. And by harm, he means physical harm. So the fact that, well, I decide to buy my car from Japan and not from Detroit, I have not harmed the Detroit auto workers because I did that. You know, that's kind of one of the ways that many of these ideas, another one that he really takes issue with is the idea of discrimination, how that has been used and perverted to reduce our freedom. But, a free people doing no harm can do all kinds of things.
They can. And, here's what I think about that. I've got a slightly more complicated take on that. You know, the harm principle is, as we call in the libertarian world, you know, the idea of positive rights. You know, you can't have your right to life, liberty, property truncated by somebody, whether a private party or a state, is a really great and useful principle, but it is a political principle. You know, it's a question of how do we model government. And yes, that's how I want government to be modeled. If we're going to have a state that gets involved in our lives, where I want it to get involved, just to get involved to protect us from having our rights violated by people, you know, to protect us from harm. That's the job of government. If government has a job, it's to protect life, liberty, and property, right? But that is not, I think, an adequate governing principle for a broader society. It's a really good principle for how you run your government, but there's a lot more to a healthy society than what its government is shaped like. And I think, and I have long thought, that we have a positive moral obligation to help the poor, the defenseless, the vulnerable, the sick, the homeless, and all the rest of it. The truth is we can do a lot better job of doing that outside of the welfare state. We can apply much more effective models for helping people who, for whatever reason, cannot help themselves than we can through the state. You know, and the public schools are a mess. They serve almost nobody very well. We can do a better job educating kids who don't have the resources to get a good education on their own outside of the public school system than we can inside it. You know, the public housing projects are a mess. We can do a much better job, you know, voucherizing and doing other sorts of approaches to housing for the homeless and other people who are economically marginal than we can through the federal government trying to run it. You know, healthcare, is there anything worse than Medicaid? Is there a worse run program in the country than Medicaid? I can't think of one. You know, we can do a lot better for people on almost every axis that you would want to try to improve the lives of people who need some help from their neighbors. You can do it better outside the state than you can inside the state. So, I sometimes resist this kind of, you know, you get this with the RAND people a lot, this idea that the harm principle is the only moral principle, which I don't think is correct, and I don't think it's a good way to present the case, and I don't think it's a good way to organize a society, but I think it's a really good principle for limiting what governments are allowed to do. But we can do a lot more than that, and we should do a lot more than that, because, you know, even in a, you know, the Nozickian utopia, there are going to be people who cannot provide for themselves. I mean, there are going to be people who are disabled, people who are mentally disabled, people who have mental disorders, people who have other sorts of problems, they're going to be children, right? They're going to be people who can't help themselves. And we as libertarians need to do, I think, a better job of outlining, you know, our counter-institutions and what we want to do for these people instead of the welfare state. One, because it's politically necessary to do so, because you can't beat something with nothing. But secondly, because we really need to do the hard work of thinking through what our institutions are going to look like. And that's part of what I'm trying to get to in this book, is saying, well, you know, it's hard to predict exactly what an institution will look like, but you can certainly, you know, lay the ground and say, well, here's some options. Here's some things we've done in the past. Here's some things we could do in the future. And one of the things I've noticed over the years is that if you really want to see what people are capable of in terms of innovation when they're not being bothered too much by their government, look what criminals are up to. Because criminals are the people who are far, far outside of the system, and they're usually involved in, you know, bad, harmful, destructive, antisocial activities of various kinds. They do, you know, also engage in some really useful innovation. You know, use of things like advanced privacy technology is something that really grew up more in the criminal underworld than it did in the business community, and something I'm writing about a good deal, which is the privatization of currency. You know, the criminal world already essentially has private currency. You know, they've got various ways of doing it. They use, you know, prepaid gift cards. They use commodities like cocaine and other sorts of things. There are electronic exchanges where people buy and sell things like frequent flyer miles and points in rewards programs and things like that. And it turns out that these are every bit as fungible as government-issued currencies. They are, if anything, a better store of value because they don't really suffer from inflation all that much. And the problem is there's really high transaction costs. You know, by which I mean it's difficult to use them. It costs you money to get involved in a system like that. Now, our government has been fighting like hell when people like Liberty Dollars and other firms have tried to issue competing currencies, and they're charging them with counterfeiting, which is just ridiculous. They're not counterfeiting. They're not making fake dollars. They're trying to make better dollars. But the truth is you're going to see innovation, particularly in the field of currencies, I think, in the very near future. The question is, will it happen in the United States? Will it happen somewhere else? You know, Singapore has already, you know, very aggressive laws about banking privacy and financial privacy, things like that. They're the sort of country that might be inclined to let people do some innovation in terms of issuing banknotes, currencies, things like that, because they'd like to profit from it and because they want to be the world's financial center. They want Singapore to be what, you know, City of London once was, and Wall Street arguably still is, but is becoming less and less of every day, which is the world's financial capital.
I just had an interesting thought of an anecdote I can talk to you about, where the only country I was ever in that you could go into a shop and you could the shop would take any currency from any country in the world, any currency, and it was a country that I believe was run by a criminal organization. It was the Soviet Union.
Yeah, anything but a ruble, right?
Right, anything but a ruble. In fact, in the Soviet Union, I was over there, actually when I was in the Air Force, and they had Berioska shops, they called them. You had to have a foreign passport to enter them, so much for the classless society. The ordinary poor Russian people could not walk into these places. And they were the only place that had anything that was even resembled any kind of a nice souvenir that you would want to bring back, maybe a musical instrument or a, you know, some kind of woodworking of some kind. But they had prices in every item was in 20 currencies. And it didn't matter what you had, they took it.
Yeah,
Try doing that in the United States.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, of course, part of that is that the dollar still is worth a little bit more than it was. It's still a real currency, although it's becoming less of one every day. But yeah, I'm not saying, you know, I don't endorse, you know, these sorts of criminal activities, but you can learn a lot about what the world is doing by looking at what the criminals are doing.
Yeah.
And the way they innovate. You know, there's a great deal of social innovation out there, but do we want to limit it to drug dealers and human traffickers and other sorts of, you know, horrible human beings? Or do we want to set people a little bit more free and let people with good intentions and the intention to create social value and to create better lives and better prosperity for people innovate as well. You know, particularly when it comes to things like education and healthcare. I mean, these are so important. Education really shapes someone's trajectory in life. I was tremendously lucky that I went to good schools and got sort of put on the right course, but that doesn't happen for a lot of people, and we could certainly make it happen for a lot more people than it does. You know, it's education at the beginning of your life and healthcare at the end of your life. In the middle, you can kind of take care of yourself pretty much, but we really could do a lot more on those things than we do.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about, how can we provide better for, people through a private sector. And I believe, Ludwig von Mises and most of the big Austrians have always emphasized that the greatest anti-poverty program that ever existed is a thing called capitalism.
Yeah, a job.
A job, capitalism. And capitalism drives the price of essential services down, and so you become wealthier, you eat better, you are better clothed and fed and taken care of in all kinds of different ways, and then those who still fall through the cracks through either no fault of their own or through weakness of character, there is more capital in the country to take care of those people. Now, I've got an example right here in Iowa City, where I'm working part-time teaching at the University of Iowa here. My wife works at the big hospital, the University Hospital, and the Carver family are just such benefactors to that university. There's the Carver Cancer Center. There's the Carver this. My wife told me just a couple months ago that the Carvers came in and gave millions and millions of more dollars to the, to the University Hospital. Now, you have to think, I don't really know who the Carvers are, but they could go out and buy, an island in the Aegean Sea. I guess they could go buy a yacht. They could have there's unlimited want, but what they want to do is build a cancer center for people. Yeah, I mean, it's just it warms your heart.
Yeah, it does. You know, here in New York, every good thing was built by a robber baron from the universities to the libraries.
Well, folks, we're coming to the end of this segment, so stay right with us. We'll be back for another short segment after these messages, so hang in there. So, folks, welcome back. This is Pat Barron, your guest host for Radio Free Market, and our guest today is Kevin Williamson. And, Kevin, I would like to get back to a subject that we talked a little bit on in the last longer segment, which is money, and it appears to me that the breakdown of big government is being we are observing it the most in the breakdown of money. And I wondered if you'd just care to expand upon that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, two things you're seeing. One is in the Eurozone, you're seeing the decay of government monopoly currencies accelerated because they've got a single currency. What you had over the course of the years before that was individual countries would get into trouble, their currencies would depreciate, they would default, they would do whatever happened at that time. And they would take a beating and they would get it built back over the years. But since the creation of the Eurozone, everybody's got the same currency, and so they've all got to fail together now. So it's making their collective insolvency much more obvious in a very actually efficient kind of way. So we can maybe thank the Europeans for doing that. And what's happening in the United States is largely the same thing, where you've got the federal government, in a sense, backstopping these insolvent states and municipalities in its own insolvent ways. And you've got the Fed buying right now all the debt that Treasury is issuing to the tune of $100 billion a month or whatever it is. But one of these days they're going to have to stop doing that, and we'll find out then whether the markets really believe that much in the dollar, whether they don't. You know, libertarians always make a big thing about the government's monopoly on violence, the use of force, which is an important point. But another thing that's been, hugely important in the last 100 years is the government's monopoly on money. Money is the fundamental piece of financial technology. There's nothing else that we would ever use that we'd allow the government to have that kind of monopoly on. We wouldn't let them have a monopoly on cars or cell phones or banking or anything else, but we let them have a monopoly on money. And I suspect that once the government has to really start competing in that marketplace, that it will, by its own reaction to normal competitive market forces, become smaller, more effective, more efficient. It will start to limit itself to the things that it's actually there to do and stop trying to do things like run the overseas private insurance corporation and bases in 50 countries and all the other stuff that we do in terms of governmental overreach. So that's going to be a key innovation, I think. And I think that the end of the government's monopoly on money is coming very soon. Well, actually, it's already here. I mean, that's what the gold rally is all about. It's people saying we no longer believe in the dollar. We no longer have faith in government-issued currencies. We're putting our money into commodities and other sorts of things. I mean, there's a reason that every commodity price in the world's at or near a record high right now. And it's not because there's a shortage of wheat or cotton or gold. It's because no one believes in government-issued currencies anymore.
I think that the key thing there is that wheat, cotton, gold, silver, they are all commodities that cannot be manufactured with the stroke of a pen.
Right.
Or the click of a keyboard.
Doesn't even take a pen stroke. They don't even have to print dollars anymore. At least used to they had to go down to the Bureau of Printing and Engraving and do some real work. Now they just send out an email and there's $1 trillion in new liquidity on the marketplace.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's and that's going to be one of the things that really contributes to the crisis. It's going to give us a chance to evolve is the fact that governments no longer not only have no control over their finances, but they really don't have control over their money anymore. You know, and you can't just print money to inflate your debt away when you're actually still running a deficit, you know, because interest rates will stop you from doing that.
Right. You're just destroying the dollar. Well, Kevin, I tell you, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you for being our guest today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I look forward to your book that comes out next month, which is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism. I'll make sure that I get that. And we'll put that on the Radio Free Market website as recommending that to our listeners. And I'll look forward to your big book, whatever it may be named. The provisional title right now is After Leviathan. So that's going to be, I really look forward to that. So folks, this is your guest host, Pat Barron, sitting in for Michael McKay at Radio Free Market. We're on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for us to us for free. And listen to our shows on iTunes or visit our archives for easy download. So until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. So long.